The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at helicasterjane.com.
So let me go here with you then. So does every seeming miracle or enchantment, I love the word enchantment, or the magical have a scientific explanation, or are there at least, Matt, a few pocketfuls of miracles? Are there? Or does everything have an explanation?
Well, it depends upon your worldview.
Well, it depends upon your worldview. Ah, miracles. I hope your world is full of miracles and magic and words and enchantment, all which we explore today on the Helicaster Jane Show with my guest, Matt Kaplan, science correspondent with The Economist and author of an enchanting new book that explores the nexus between science and magic, Science of the Magical, from the Holy Grail to love potions, to superpowers. And in our second half hour, joining me at my table is Steve Klein Edler, executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionary, here to talk about the new entries into our lexicon this year. It's the magic of science and the enchantment of words here on the Helicaster Jane Show. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. But before we begin today, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your, yes, free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Matt Kaplan is a science correspondent with The Economist and has contributed weekly articles to its science and technology section for a decade. He has also written for National Geographic, Nature, and the New York Times. In 2014, he was awarded a Knight Science Journalism Fellowship, which he used to study the sciences at MIT and folklore at Harvard. As you are about to learn, Kaplan is a fascinating man with a fascinating mind. His curiosity on display in his equally fascinating new book, Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers. If you've ever been curious about elixirs of eternal life, fabled gateways to the underworld, the spells of witches that turn men into beasts, or the oracles of ancient Greece, Matt Kaplan is your perfect armchair guide when antiquated myth and scientific inquiry coalesce, as Kaplan takes us on a tour across the world to explore the nexus between science and magic. Let's talk. So, Matt, before we even get into this book, I have to get into you. You really do have quite an unusual mind. And tell me about Matt the Kid. That's what I first want to know about. What interested you? What influenced your thought? I mean, how did you get from there to here, really?
Well, there's one thing that seems to have run along the whole spectrum of my life. From a very early age, I loved fossils. I loved dinosaurs. And I was born in Los Angeles, and I spent much of my childhood going to the tar pits, which aren't dinosaurs. They're just ancient mammals, but still incredibly cool. And I kept wondering to myself, even as a little boy, how did these get here, and what do these bones tell us about what was here before Los Angeles became this gargantuan city? Because the tar pits were there, you know, a million years ago. Well, what's going on? And when you think about this kind of writing that I'm doing now, it's not that different. I mean, I got a degree as a paleontologist, but I like looking at myths and legends and picking them apart for little fragments of bone, as it were, to ask myself, is this stuff based on anything in the real world, or is it all entirely imagined? And that's really what where Science of Monsters came from, and it's where Science of the Magical came from, too.
It's fascinating. Magic and science, you know, in the same sentence, Matt. I mean, some people would call that an absolute oxymoron, but I don't think you do, obviously. So you touched on it. What?
It's funny you should say that, because one of the things that is hardest, what was hardest about writing the book, was being able to actually use those in the same sentence and not feel derailed because of the way we look at these things.
Yeah, I said that you are unusual. Here's why I think you're unusual. I think you're unusual because most people are either right-brain thinkers or left-brain thinkers, and they don't have an amalgamation of both. And it is clear from this terrific book that you do. You have the sensitivity, and you're a scientist. That fascinates me. You don't run across that often. You really, really don't. So kudos to you, buddy. Really. Well, okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I one of the things that I really actually enjoy is moving back and forth between the two fields. I find it stimulating and challenging in all sorts of wonderful ways. And when you can bring in disparate fields like folklore and chemistry and actually have a sensible conversation about them at the same time, that just rocks.
For sure, absolutely. So let's get to that, because to understand this confluence of magic and science that you take up in this book, understand what you're talking about. Knowing shapes magic? Maybe you want to share some examples from the book.
Yeah, sure. So to a certain extent, knowing how the world works does shape our perceptions of magical things. So, but that's really what you're really targeting here is the conclusion of the book, which is kind of a funny place to start, but we can go there. So, for example, if you have a magic worldview, and by that I mean if for you the world is crackling with magic and the things that you don't understand are automatically explained by you with gods and monsters and sorcery, then that's it. Whenever you see something you don't understand, you're going to use mythology to explain it. And that was very much the reality for many of our ancestors. But simultaneously, we do our ancestors a disservice by blanketing them all and saying, oh, they were all a bunch of folks who only had a magic worldview. And I'll explain why. So the berserker warriors, who were these guys who went charging up the French coast to chop up Frenchmen who wouldn't trade with them. All these people had this idea that Vikings were just these terrorists on the coast, but really they were very well-armed businessmen who just got angry when Christians wouldn't trade with pagans. But if you told them that they were entering their berserker rage because they were taking a biochemical combination of henbane and other goods that made them numb to pain when people shot them with arrows or stabbed them with swords, they would have hacked you to pieces. That's because the Vikings very much had a magic worldview. There was no other explanation, at least as far as we know, on their end. But if you go to, let's say, the Oracle of Delphi, we don't know what was actually going on in her mind, because the oracle at any given point, because there were many of them, did not write down what she was thinking. But we do have a high priest whose name was Plutarch. And Plutarch, towards the end of the reign of the oracle, started hypothesizing that there was something geologic about the site. He started suggesting that after a big earthquake that had hit the site, that something had changed that had altered the oracle's powers. That's amazing, because he was looking at things from a scientific perspective, thousands of years before the scientific method was ever even a glimmer in anybody's eye. But there he was, pondering it. Same kind of concept goes with Democritus, who's often considered one of the earliest scientists. Democritus looked at this tradition of liver reading. Do you remember that section of the book?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe this stuff. I mean, seriously, who goes to a prophet or a soothsayer and says, hey, my uncle is ill. Could you please go slay that goat and see if the gods are going to keep him alive or kill him off?
Right.
I mean, this is insane. Who looks at the liver for that sort of stuff? I mean, so when I read the literature on livers, I was really shocked, because who would take that seriously? But Democritus was writing about the ancients. And I find that so funny, because Democritus is, what, like 400 BC? And he's writing about the ancients and saying, I think that once upon a time there was something to liver reading. And in his writing, he says, he points out that that he, let me see if I have an actual quote here. The ancients widely established that the entrails of sacrificed animals and the condition of their liver and color of the liver were sometimes prophetic of health, sickness, and sterility of the field.
Fascinating, right?
I mean, that's wild, because what he was really saying was, okay, the Mesopotamians and the Assyrians, who were, you know, 1,000 years before him, more so, they were killing goats before they were going to build farms or before they were going to build settlements. They would go out onto a hillside or into a pasture where they thought they might build a farm. They'd kill a sheep or a goat or some other animal that was living there, and they would look at the liver. And they wrote down in detail what you would look for in that liver. They wrote down, if it was dense, that was a good sign. If it was dark in color, that was a bad sign. If it was smooth, that was good. If the portal vein was blocked up, that was bad. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so I called up a couple of classicists who were working on literature today about this. And I said, have you ever thought that maybe a liver could tell you something about the ecology of a place? You know, might a liver function like tree rings? You know, because if you have a tree that's exposed to a fire but it doesn't burn down, the rings will record that there was a fire there once upon a time. And so I got to wondering, could a liver function in the same way? And the classicists were hysterical. Many of them laughed at me and said, what do I look like, a veterinary pathologist to you? And that's when I realized, oh, yeah, right. I write for The Economist. I'm the science correspondent. I know lots of veterinary pathologists. So I started calling up veterinary pathologists, and all of them said to me, yeah, livers record a lot about an animal's life. And if you have a goat that's been dwelling in a pasture for 10 years, you go kill the old goat, take out its liver, you're going to be able to see if the area has been hit periodically by drought. You're going to be able to see if the area has been hit by pestilence. You're going to know what happened in the past. And as a paleontologist, we were taught very well that the past helps us to predict the future. And very much, you know, with regards to climate change right now, folks are looking in the fossil record to try to see how animals adapted to extreme shifts in climate that occurred before, so that we can better understand what's going to hit our planet, you know, in 15 years.
So
you can do the same thing with livers.
This is why you fascinate me. This is why I'm, first of all, my mind is reeling after studying all of this with your book, okay, for the last 24 hours. I mean, reeling, do you hear me? And that's why I'll jump from place to place, because there's just so much I want to get to and so many rat holes I want to go down with you. And that's what you like to do, by the way. You like to go down the rat holes. And that's why this is also fascinating. You know, Mr. Scientist, do phrases like divine intervention, miracle, supernatural sorcery mean something wholly different to you than to us mere mortals who aren't the scientists? I mean, listen to your excitement. That's what I want to understand about you. Is that it? Is that what gets your juices going? I mean, these things.
I think part of it is I like to challenge. I like to challenge authority. I like to challenge systems, and I have so much admiration for the scientists who step up and say, you know what, I'm really curious about this, and I want to study it. So, you know, in 2013, a study came across my desk where these researchers were looking at the effects of different types of happiness on immune expression in your body. And the paper was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is a peer-reviewed journal that a lot of scientists around the world would shed blood to get into. I mean, big deal. And it's you know, you can get a bad study in there, but it's uncommon. And the study basically showed that there are two types of happiness. We already knew that, but it delved into it and said, look, you can have hedonic happiness, which is associated with winning a slot machine at Vegas, or you can have eudaimonic happiness, which is the happiness of helping an old lady across the street. They feel the same to us, but really, they actually they're expressed differently by your body. And the team looked at people who were chronically eudaimonically happy versus people who were chronically hedonically happy, and they took blood from them periodically throughout the experiment. And they noticed that the folks who had chronic eudaimonic happiness were expressing all these genes associated with viral and bacterial attack. Their immune systems were just so well built to cope with pathogens. And that's crazy, because in the scriptures it says, Jesus says many times in Mark and Luke and I think even Matthew, your faith has healed you. So I called up the scientists and said, I'm just curious, you know, have you ever considered the possibility that, you know, Jesus was right, or that Jesus was onto something? Would being associated with religion lead you to engage in more eudaimonically happy activities? And I remember Barb Fredrickson at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, kind of like wavering on the other side of the line. Because to say Jesus was right when you're in the world of academia, that's dangerous. That's a good way to get yourself isolated.
Killed, so, even.
she was so careful in her phrasing. She said, well, you know, pinning your life to this fabric of something so much bigger than your own, going on a pilgrimage, sacrificing your family's only goat, there are goats again, goats keep coming up, to the God that you love, these would all trigger eudaimonic feelings. And so, you know, the concept of people going and praying together to help someone get better and having that person be involved in the practice and know that they're part of the larger community, she said, yeah, that could grant some health benefits. I mean, it's the Bible. I'm not saying the Bible's right when Jesus puts his hands on someone and it cures them of leprosy. I'm not saying that, you know, you're going to cure yourself of leprosy with eudaimonic happiness. But there are health benefits that we're starting to work out. And what's so amazing is that study was replicated this year by a second study. So, you know, that's the gold standard in science, is when you do something twice or three times or four times and you keep getting the same result, that means you're probably onto something. And I just find that so amazing. And those kinds of questions are what really get me going.
And I get that, but I have to ask you this then, as the scientist.
Sure.
Where do you come down on this thing? And you know, there is this war right now, particularly on the climate thing, you know, between science and religion, and it all gets kind of, where are you on this?
It is only a war when you talk with fundamentalists, and you don't need it to be you don't need to be religious to be a fundamentalist. You can be a fundamentalist scientist, you can be a fundamentalist believer in faith. The problem in our world today is that we do not have enough moderacy. Moderation. We don't have enough moderates anymore. In American government, we've gerrymandered districts to the point where you're only going to be nominating people who are extremist right-wingers or extremist left-wingers. Extremism and fundamentalism are the plague of America right now. And I think that that goes beyond just American political districts. It expands much, much further into the world of science and faith and belief. And unfortunately, a lot of the folks who are blogging, a lot of the folks who are tweeting are on extreme ends of these views because they have strong feelings. So they're going to be expressing them more aggressively. I mean, why do you think you have Rush Limbaugh as like your top host? He means he's extremely conservative. And whether you're conservative or liberal, that's a problem because you don't find many moderates anymore. I mean, and they're a dying breed.
I couldn't agree with you more.
That the lack of moderation is really where we run into trouble. If more scientists and more believers were more willing to accept each other and to listen to one another, I think we'd make a lot of headway.
And as a scientist, how does this affect your work?
Well, okay, so you have to remember, I'm a scientist who turns to the dark side. I'm a science journalist. I'm the science correspondent at The Economist. So, and I've got a team of other science correspondents who I work with closely, and all of us have a science background and were once scientists. But there was this time when I was starting out where to give up my academic career publishing papers on paleontology was viewed as like, what are you doing with your life? Why would you ever go into science journalism? What's the point? You could be an academic, and that's so much better. And really, that's also to miss the point, and that's also to fall to extremism once more. As soon as you say all or nothing, it's either academia or nothing, you're really losing out. The world needs communicators. The world needs good science journalists. There aren't enough of us.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, it's important to be able to understand the scientific method, to understand that, you know, just because you see one study published in a journal and that the Huffington Post picks up and says, wow, this is amazing. It's going to change our world. It's going to change the treatment of cancer. It's one study. It needs to be repeated at least five times. And the problem with the media, no one cares when a study gets repeated. That's old news. No one's interested. But actually, that's the most important thing in the world.
So let me go here with you then. So does every seeming miracle or enchantment, I love the word enchantment, or the magical have a scientific explanation, or are there at least, Matt, a few pocketfuls of miracles? Are there? Or does everything have an explanation?
Well, it depends upon your worldview. If you're a berserker warrior of the Norse tradition, then there would be plenty of miracles. My mind is very sharply shaped to look for what's sitting underneath. I go and see Penn and Teller perform in Las Vegas, and it's almost impossible for me to sit there and not try to tease out what's actually going on. And to a certain extent, that annoys me, because if I could just sit back and watch and relax and enjoy it, I think I'd have a much better time. I think I drive myself crazy trying to pick apart, how did they do that? What's going on? And for me, I view that as a tragedy. I wish that I could just put on my suspension of disbelief and just relish the moment. And I remember one moment in the show where I really managed it. There's this moment where a teller takes water and turns it into gold coins in front of this older woman. And there was just a fraction of a moment where the scientist in me stopped working and just said, that's incredible. That's so impressive. I don't care how he did it. It's just a beautiful thing. And in fact, when I was interviewing him for this book, one of the things that he pointed out was by focusing on beauty, there is this sense of getting people to just appreciate the beauty of magic. And I think that that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I'm very amused about the fact that you go see Penn and Teller and that you're fascinated by that, because I'm much more the opposite of you in terms of who I am. I have both sides. I think you can figure that out. But you know, I go from the emotional and from the, you know, artistic and whatever. That kind of rules my thing. And I can't stand magic. What does that say? That's fascinating. Well, maybe because I see it like you do in one sense. I keep going there and can't suspend the disbelief. Maybe that's it. So that's
it
my
could
science
be that.
Side.
I mean, some people are just put off by Vegas. I mean, I'm definitely one of them.
Yeah, I don't like Vegas. I'm not a Vegas person either. I'm with you on that one. Yeah, no, it's fascinating.
I think I actually put it into the introduction of the book. You know, our ancestors went on these pilgrimages to Delphi to ask for explorations of the supernatural world and to study magicians. And here I was on a flight to Vegas. And I felt distinctly uncomfortable as we were landing, and I saw the Eiffel Tower in the middle of a desert. It's a little bit disturbing. I think I'm in agreement there. But at the same time, there are these moments where modern technology and modern artistry, because I think modern magic, like the stage version, is kind of a mix of science and art. And I get into that in the book too, in the last chapter. I think that you can see these moments where the technology and the skill of performers combine to create these moments where you go, whoa, that's just, I took one of my nieces to Disneyland a number of years ago, and they were doing one of these shows with these spouts of water with color shooting through the tubes of water. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that kind of stuff, but still there was this moment where they managed to get the music and the lights and everything just right, where it was almost impossible to not be blown away by it. And I think to a certain sense that plays into the sense of what is magical.
That's interesting, because I don't like Disneyland either. I like it when I was a kid. Obviously, we need science, but I'm wondering if you believe that mankind could live with science but no miracles. Would it be too difficult to endure if we said no magic, no enchantment, no, right?
Well, you've just used several words, and I wonder if you can define them. You just use magic, miracles, and enchantment,
right,
all interchangeably. Are they the same thing?
I think they're of the same family, if not necessarily the same thing.
I toyed very much with creating a book entitled Science of Miracles. I mean, that was almost the title of this book. And then I realized, well, a lot of the stuff in here would not be deemed a miracle. And so I sensed that it probably was not the right title to use, although it would have sounded better. It probably would have done, you know, even better than this one is doing. But I do not think that miracles and magic are the same thing. In fact, I think they fall into very different categories. A miracle has a very, very solid positive connection to the term. You know, you can't have bad miracles, can you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know much about miracles themselves. You know, they're things that we hear about. I haven't personally
witnessed. No, but you have them in mythology.
Yeah, no, and that's where I go. Yeah,
and we have them in the Bible.
And I was going to throw back that word.
When someone's resurrected, that's a miracle, right?
Right. I was going to throw back that word too, by the way. I was going to throw back the word myth, because maybe in there, you know, when myth is something that a lot of people can't even put their fingers on, which is something that I think you do very well in the book. But that might fit into that realm, myth, miracle, mythology, enchantment. There's an inability to grasp it completely.
Well, I think magic is still very much alive in our world because, you know, science can't explain everything. And people, including some scientists, when they look at things that they can't understand, their brain will often go to that territory and say, well, there's something else there that, you watch scientists really work with this. I don't know if you remember the regeneration section of my book, but there's a section where I was interviewing one of these researchers who works on the biology of the human liver. And she was pointing out to me that in 1931, a couple of researchers demonstrated that you could chop out 2/3 of a rat's liver and surgically close the rat up, and the liver grows right back. You can't do that with any other organ. You can chop out 2/3 of a heart, a lung, anything else. It's not coming back. You're in serious trouble, too. Chop out 2/3 of a rat's liver, no problem. It'll be back there, and it'll be back there in like 24 hours. It's crazy. And the same is true for human livers, although there are all kinds of rules against running experiments like that. But, you know, talking to them and saying, so why? Why and how does the human liver grow back so fast? What's going on there? And the quote, which I think I included in the book, now I know I included it in the book, was, we really need magic to explain that because we do not know.
So magic is the definition of what we don't know. That certainly is interesting. Liz, let me move on because I love this book, more on science of the magical. Love the chapters. Love what you explore. You go into healing, prayer, sacred pool, regeneration, holy eyeliner, or let's get back to my favorite word, enchantment, love potions, yeah, sleeping draughts, mind-altering fruit. You wrote this. I didn't. Penises paired with stingray spines. Oh, man. Talk to me.
Yeah. You know, we all have our moments.
I mean, this book just takes you on such a vast trip. I even love the beginning you open with the parting of the Red Sea. Talk about that.
You know, I'll tell you, I could have really focused on the magic of the Odyssey, or I could have focused on the magic of the Bible and made the book thematic and associated with just one very small area. But the problem is it's not my nature, and it's the same reason why I'm not a research scientist for a profession. I somehow knew deep down, after spending 2 years staring at the fossilized teeth of marmots dug up in Yellowstone National Park, that, you know, that there would be no way I would ever be able to survive a career where I had to do the same exact thing every day for 2 years and you know, put all my energies into a single paper that's going to go and be read by 8 people. That just was never going to happen. I love studying and learning. And this book, as you probably have noticed, represents the fact that I just delve into a lot of different areas, get really excited, and love to explore. But I'm not one for sitting down and doing tedious work that will give you one whole chapter all about the parting of the Red Sea. That'll be one section of one chapter. And that's more in my nature, and personally, I think it's more fun to read.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating the way you played that. I really did like the beginning of the book. You brought up Penn and Teller. Does knowing how something magical works make it into something other than magic? Let me add this. Does knowing how something magical works make it less magical? And do both questions presume or assume that magic is more magical than science? I mean, talk about what Teller talk to you about briefly, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, sure. So I think knowing how something magical works transforms it in a distinct way. The degree to which it transforms it, and whether that is positive or negative, depends on your worldview. If you were, for example, a berserker warrior living at the time of the Vikings, and you truly believed that that mead that you drank or the potion that you rubbed into your skin was a gift from Odin. I mean, that was, as far as we know, the case. And I walked up to that berserker warrior and said, hey, did you know that those are henbane seeds and that they're loaded with pharmaceuticals that are giving you that effect and it has nothing to do with Odin whatsoever? Seriously, they take a double-edged axe and they hack me to pieces. So, you know, and they'd be very angry about it because they had a magical worldview. If I were to walk up to someone who was already living in a secular age and say, hey, did you realize that thing that you thought was an angel floating over a mountain was in fact the beginning of a volcanic eruption? Or did you realize that that thing that you saw in the sky was actually Aurora Borealis? It depends upon who they are and what their perspective is. Some people might go, no way, really? And others might be offended and upset. And I think it's as the response is as diverse as the diversity of the human population.
I've been speaking with Matt Kaplan, author of Science of the Magical, From the Holy Grail to Love Potions to Superpowers, by way of Scribner, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, available at fine bookstores everywhere. Steve Kleinedler is executive editor of the Reference Group at Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of American Heritage Dictionary and Webster's New World Reference Works. He joined the editorial staff of the American Heritage Dictionary in 1997. Steve earned a BA in linguistics from Northwestern University and attended graduate school at the University of Chicago for linguistics. A professional lexicographer, he familiarizes himself with the vocabulary in specific subject areas, researches and analyzes new developments and usage, and works with expert consultants to ensure that the content of the dictionaries is as accurate and as up-to-date as possible. So, what's new this year? This year, the editors of the American Heritage Dictionaries revised thousands of entries and added over 500 new words and senses to the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. Let's talk. So, Steve, don't you have an interesting job? Words are your business. I guess I better be careful about what words I choose in our conversation today. But honestly, interesting, informative, and fun. But let's start with this. In 2015, American Heritage Dictionary added 500 new words and senses to the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. That's a mouthful. I think I understand word, but what do you mean by senses?
We add not only new words, we add new senses. So, for example, a very simple way to look at that is 30, 40 years ago, with the rise of computer science, there were new senses of the word window and cut and paste and so forth. So in this case, a new sense is a word that has existed and a new additional application of that word or a new sense of that word has come into being. And so that's what we mean when we refer to new senses.
Okay. 500 words. Is that what your limit is? Or are there more words than that that come into the lexicon? Or you just stop at 500?
It's roughly 500. I forget whether it was like 493 or 512 or whatever. It was a convenient round number. The only limitation, of course, is the size of our staff. And there's more revision going on than just adding new material. So, for example, in the last year, our staff added, we reviewed over 6,000 entries and we made about 2,000 revisions. That's where we didn't add anything new, but we changed the way something might be phrased, revised it, brought it up to date. And then the 500 new words and senses, it just happened to be that's in the work and in the review, there ended up being that many things that were brand new.
How do you get these words?
It depends on the area that it comes from. For example, if scientists synthesize a new chemical element and add it to the periodic table of the chart, their committee gets together and they say, we are calling this fluorovium or we are calling this livermorium. And there you go. That's all you need is the fact that that committee that's in charge of doing it made that declaration. Obviously, that doesn't work for most words. In some cases, it's when our editors are working in conjunction with various consultants in specialized areas. I brought up physics, for example. For the fifth edition, we had at least three physics consultants because this is such a huge area of scientific endeavor. And in reviewing the existing information, our consultants may say, in the past 15 years, X, Y, and Z has become an important part. This is something that we should cover and work on. In some cases, it's our own editorial staff making these decisions. You'll notice, for example, on the list that we provided, one of the terms that we added is actually a relatively older term. That is TOSOC, You know, the article of clothing where the socks have individual nubbins for the toes, the way a glove might have for fingers. Those were popularized in the 70s, and there was a revival in the 90s, and they came back to the, you know, with the toe shoes for running. One of our editors, who was doing an overhaul of the clothing terminology when she was going through all of the footwear words, she realized that we didn't enter this. It was a hole in the vocabulary, and she proposed adding it, and so we did.
So talk to me about this, because this whole thing is just utterly fascinating to me. Words are such strange things. I mean, obviously, some words, like the one you just mentioned, have to do with something being introduced to culture. But words also morph, right, in meaning. Explain all of that.
I think if you look at the cultural aspects, a good place to talk about that is food terminology. And every year, this becomes a very easy way for the layperson to get a handle on some of the stuff that we're doing. If you think back 50, 60 years ago, people like Julia Child were popularizing French cuisine, and you know, she had a cooking show, there were cookbooks, that sort of thing. And at that time, there were a fair amount of French cooking terms and French food words that found their way into the English lexicon, and over the period of time became as much an English word as they were a French word. In that regard, you know, in the past several decades, as the tastes of American cuisine expands globally, we've taken on a lot of words from all over the country. All over the world. And one of these words that we added this year is a Korean dish called bibimbap, which is rice and vegetables and chili paste and a raw egg, and it's served in a very hot stone bowl, so hot that the food is actually continuing to cook after it's been placed in front of the person who's going to eat it. This is a old Korean word. People who have lived near or in Korean restaurants are probably familiar with it from some time ago. And with the rise of so many cooking shows, entire networks devoting to cooking, more and more these types of items are being discussed and tasted and brought about. And one indication that this is a word that's entering English as opposed to a foreign word that people are using is the fact that you see it now outside of Korean neighborhoods, outside of Korean restaurants, and being discussed in newspapers and on shows without an explanation of what it is, as though one should already be familiar with it. And that's an indication that this word has become anglicized and therefore worthy of inclusion.
It's a great sounding word, by the way. I love it. Bibimbap.
Thank you.
Don't you love it? What about, and there, let's stay on food as long as you brought food up. There are a couple of words that, that have been introduced. Mm-hmm. Churrasco?
Yes. Churrasco, and the place where one would get churrasco, which is a churrascaria. If you live in an area of the country that has a lot of people from Brazil or Portugal or Argentina, it's a very popular form, not only of the food itself, but the manner in which it is served. It's grilled meat that in a typical churrascaria, servers will walk around with large skewers or in some case swords with the meat skewered on the skewer, and they'll come to your table and they'll hold it up, and with the knife in the other hand, they'll slice this material directly onto your plate.
Hmm. Sounds divine, actually. How about galera?
It's really quite delicious.
Is it? I'm going to have to go try that
back
now.
When I was living up, I'm sorry.
I said, I'm going to have to go try that.
It's become more and more popular. There's some chains now that actually serve it. When I was living up near Boston, there are several such restaurants in Cambridge. It's really well cooked too. It's very delicious.
Okay, galera. That's an interesting word, galera.
Yes. This is another example of how review will turn up things. Galera is a type of grape, specifically the type of grape grown in a region of Italy that makes that is used to make Prosecco. In doing a review of specifically beers and wines and the like, there were a couple editors working on this, and the person who was in charge of wine was looking at our treatment of grapes, why we cover some grapes and not other grapes. And so we worked together to regularize some of that and include some of the grapes that hadn't been included before, including this one, Galera.
Let's talk about, too, the general interest terms. And Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about this because there, it's culture, it's popularity. In some terms, but what can I throw in the word slang just because I think it needs to be thrown into this conversation before we do that? Mm-hmm. Talk to me, slang.
Slang is a very productive mechanism by which words start out in a specific segment of the population, any of a number of niche segments. It could be a social group, an ethnic group, a religious group, something by trade, you know, plumbers or longshoremen or actors or what have you. Teenagers are another social group where slang is productively arises from. And over the course of time, some slang extends beyond the group that initiated it or began using it and becomes more nationally recognized. Not all slang terms, in fact, relatively few slang terms make it that far, but some do. And then they are brought into the lexicon in that manner. The American Heritage Dictionary isn't, there are plenty of slang dictionaries out there. We're not really known for treatment of slang because there are plenty of publications that do that very well. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's just not one of our focuses.
The reason that I brought it up is because I see words that were slang turning into words that are no longer slang and become just part of the lexicon, yes?
Yes.
Right. And you do those.
That's a very productive way of how languages stay alive. You know, out of any given, you take 25 terms that teenagers might have used 5 years ago, a handful have probably survived and carry on. If you look at the 80s perspective, you know, who's still using tubular, for example, to mean awesome?
but some of the words that are on the general interest terms, they kind of interest me.
Right. Oh.
Go ahead. Were you going to say something?
Oh, no, I was going to give you an example.
Oh, okay. I was going to throw one at you, but you go first. This is your game. Go.
Okay, cool. And it's probably the one you were going to throw at me anyway, because it's the one that people when I've been speaking about the subject that radio hosts have really enjoyed speaking about and podcasters. It's humble brag.
Great word.
Which we define as a superficially modest or self-deprecating statement that is clearly intended to impress others. It's a relatively new term, but it's one that's really taken on a life of its own because I think people find it very descriptive. Certainly anyone who's suffered through a long-winded holiday letter sent from a person that only one hears from once a year, tucked into a holiday card, some of these turn out to be these epic stories, which ends up being a very kind of a detailed brag about how awesome their children is or their yacht trips or whatever. And when they're presented in such a way that, you know, they're like making an effort to sound humble, but they're really just bragging. That would be a humble brag.
You know why I like that word? It's so a sign of our times. Isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it fascinates me. Here's another great word. Listicle. Love this word.
Listicle. Yes. A listicle is a article or an essay or any sort of news that is presented in a numbered format, in a numbered list, which if your listenership, any of them, and I'm sure most of them do, read the internet at all, this is how so much information is conveyed nowadays. In fact, there are some websites that consist of nothing but numbered articles. And, you know, part of this is for financial reasons, if they're being paid advertising dollars based on clicks or on eyeballs, a numbered list makes information very easy to digest. You can set up the website so that each numbered item is on its own page, which requires more clicks than to get through the article. It's really become an ubiquitous way of condensing information and displaying it for, maximized advertising revenue.
I'm going to take you out to the one more word that's on was thrown at me, and I love the sound of this word. And that may just be something I'm weird about. Some words just sound better than other words. The word zarf. Isn't that a great sounding word?
Yes, zarf is a great word, and it's a good example of an existing word that now has a new sense. It's an everyday item. There are so many things that we see every day that we don't realize have names. For example, the little plastic or metal end of a shoelace has a specific name. Those are called aglets, A-G-L-E-T. And so, too, the cardboard sleeve that you that is placed around your hot coffee or hot tea when you are served it in a paper container. Those that such a sleeve is called a zarf, Z-A-R-F. It ultimately is from the Arabic word zarf, meaning container. It's an older English word and an Arabic word. In the Middle East, when hot drinks are served, they're often served with these really ornamental metallic holders that are kind of chalice-like. And such each of those things is known as a zarf. And so that word was picked up from that thing and extended to refer to these cardboard sleeves.
I love that. I love that. We're going to change categories because there's so many great categories in this. And let's go to technology and science, which absolutely fascinated me for a host of reasons. One being that technology seems to be ruling our day right now. So any words that you would bring in at this point, you know, it's funny. Technology used to be for the technical or technocrats. I think it's for everybody these days. Here's one that's amazing. Co-sleeping. Wow. Fascinating.
Right. That is the social, it's been around for some time. It's the social trend or the, you know, where the parents will sleep with the infant or the small children in their bed on the theory that, you know, that way you don't have to get up to feed the child. It's already there. Everyone gets more sleep. You know, you'll see studies about it. And of course, the internet being what it is, you'll find people who think it's a horrible idea expressing their opinion. You'll find people who think it's a wonderful idea expressing their opinion. Regardless of what one thinks about it, it exists as a thing, and that thing is called co-sleeping.
Yeah, I guess that's a generational thing, too, or an age thing. I'm past that age of the kids. It didn't come across my radar. Here's one that's fascinating also, DOX, D-O-X-X, or DOX, D-O-X. Words reflective of society's ills? Ah, the wonderful world of social media. Talk to me.
Yeah, so I think this term, certainly people who frequent comment sections on the internet may have been more familiar, but it was really Gamergate and all the conversation that came out from that. Especially with all the online harassment that brought this word into the public consciousness. To dox someone, you know, the activity of doxing is to publicly disclose the identity, address, or other personal details of someone as a form of online harassment. So, you know, it becomes a, you know, it's a tool of harassment, and I think Gamergate is a really good example of that, where people, often women, who are talking out against, you know, sexism in social media, then themselves end up getting attacked with, you know, really horrible emails that don't stop, denial of service attacks on their ISP, and just some really brutal and gross electronic attacks that sometimes seep outside of cyberspace and, you know, stalkings, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a sad commentary on people's inability to behave socially appropriately. Sometimes the mask of anonymity, you know, leads people to this type of abhorrent behavior.
And it's interesting because you don't judge words. Your role is just to determine whether or not they're important to our word culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, by the same token, I mean, certainly horrific words like murder, for example, are included in the dictionary. So we're describing a very real thing. And it, you know, when major newspapers are picking up this terminology, as they did with DOX when that was in the news last summer, it's sort of our duty to describe for the user what this is.
By the same token, there are some changes in words, this one really touched me personally. Percutaneous coronary intervention. That's just a new. Talk to me. I won't even say what it is. You say what it is.
Right. One of the areas in which we've done a pretty major overhaul in the past several years is with our medical terminology. Biochemical terminology and medical terminology. Our life science editor, in conjunction with a number of consultants, have overhauled a lot of information about various medical words, which, as you can imagine, changes fairly rapidly. So percutaneous coronary interventions is what the medical community now call what we would remember once being called coronary angioplasties. It essentially is what a coronary angioplasty was, but the term that most medical providers now prefer is that. And so that's an example of, you know, why we would add something based on review, and in this case, it's because what the medical community itself now uses.
Do you get into why these words change? I mean, I know if you look in a dictionary, it'll tell you the history of a word. You know, did you understand why these words go through this morphing?
In some cases, due to societal changes. For example, the use of intellectual disability instead of mental retardation. Certainly, over the course of in that case, that was also in part due to the DSM-5 being published at the, which is what the psychiatric community uses to diagnose various patients' disorders and diseases and the like. In this case, to answer your question specifically, in this case, no. It's kind of beyond our scope to catalog the reasons for all these kinds of changes. But when they are socially relevant, we will include a usage note to explain. It's usually when it deals with offensive terminology, when a word to describe, for example, a specific ethnic group was once used and is now considered offensive to do so, we'll include a note to explain, how it has come to be that this word that your grandparents or great-grandparents may have used is now considered offensive and why you should avoid it.
Words affect... This is kind of one of those twister kind of things, but it is curious to me. Society reflects words. Do words affect society? Let me rephrase that.
Well, I understand where you're going with that.
Yeah.
But to some extent, yes. I mean, it's kind of it's hard to separate the two because language is such an embedded part of human culture that the ways in which people express themselves through the public discourse and the words that they choose to use, I think does, have, for better or for worse, or in many cases, it's probably completely neutral. But I think we can all identify cases in which it's a positive effect or a negative effect. It does cut both ways.
Linguists get into arguments just like everybody else. Certainly over the pronunciation of some words. One of those words, it was a topic of conversation in this edition. Talk to me about it. And if I say the word, it's like, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't say it because I'll say it wrong or I'll say it right. But do you know the word I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And actually, both pronunciations that I'll be discussing are correct. One of them is more traditional, and one of them is newer. And usually when that type of thing happens, people prefer the traditional, and the new pronunciation is thought to be not as good. But here's an example of one where the variant pronunciation is now the more preferred pronunciation. So the word we're talking about is the fear of the marketplace, the fear of, being out in open spaces, which some people will call agoraphobia and others will call agoraphobia. Agoraphobia is the older, more traditional pronunciation, and agoraphobia is relatively newer as far as English pronunciations go. We put this forth to our usage panel, which is a group of about 180 linguists and writers and poets and authors and Pulitzer Prize winners and crossword puzzle constructors and other people who deal with using words as part of their day-to-day living. We polled them last year as to what they thought about this. And for the first time, a majority of the panel preferred the form agoraphobia over agoraphobia. You'll see these switches happen occasionally. Harass and harass is another good example. About 20 years ago, the panel was pretty evenly split as to whether it should be harass or harass. And the last time we balloted that, which was a couple years ago, there was a 90-10 split in favor of harass, which is actually a pretty steep switch in a relatively short period of time.
One last question. You've got a whole dictionary out there. You've got years and years and years, Steve, of doing this. I mean, right? What's your favorite word in the dictionary?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I have thought about contriving an answer just so I would have a ready thing to say. But I've always likened it to asking a carpenter what their favorite nail is. In the course of the day, I'm bombarded by so much review, and it's really hard to pinpoint down a single word. One of my colleagues refers to the words as her children. She doesn't want to play favorites because she'll hurt their feelings. Pretty much everyone I know has a way of circumventing this question by saying it's too large a question to really answer.
Oh, that's not a fair one. So then I'm going to turn it around.
It's a cop-out, I know.
It's totally a cop-out. So I'm going to turn it around on you. What's your least favorite word in the dictionary?
Ooh, least favorite word? Probably ones that I have a hard time spelling. There was a word I misspelled in first grade, and I have to look it up every single time I use it, and it's very simple, and it's guard, and whether it's A-U or U-A, I for the life of me can never remember it, and so like, yeah, unless I'm doing something that's got spell correct as I type, I pretty much have to look it up.
Oh, my gosh, that's adorable. That is so funny, you know, because it just says a dyslexic lexicon. What's your official title?
A lexicographer, yes.
A lexicographer, right? With dyslexia.
Yes.
You're a sweetheart. Thank you so much. So enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you had a great time. Yeah. I really did, too.
I've been speaking with Steve Kleinidler. Never underestimate the power of the word. For more information about the print edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, check out ahdictionary.com or go to your iTunes or Android app store and purchase the app. The American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language can be purchased from your favorite online or brick and mortar bookstore. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate Producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieCasserJane.com.